We'll get into the story. We had a lot to cover today, so let's jump in. If you've been with us for the last year and a half, we've been on a long journey through the Bible. We've been on this long journey, starting in the Old Testament or the Hebrew story, the Hebrew scriptures. And we are nearly done, just for your information. By the time the holidays get here, we'll be into the Christian story of Jesus. The New Testament's coming in just a couple months or so. But today, we're still kind of on the back swing of the Hebrew story. We've seen the Old Testament where the kingdom of Israel has risen and the kingdom of Israel has collapsed. It is no longer. Both halves are gone. Jerusalem was conquered. And we are now going to enter a few weeks to talk about the captivity period. And then after the captivity, the restoration, and then we'll be done. In fact, just a little newsflash, inside information. We have seven messages to go counting today's. Seven messages to go counting today, and we're done with our Old Testament journey completely. Then we'll have a little transition before we start the New Testament and Jesus at Christmas season. So anyhow, as we get into this part of the story, we saw Jerusalem captured in multiple waves. It was conquered in three different waves, and in the earlier waves, an event happens that's going to be part of today's story during the captivity years. Now, I'm going to tell you, the story today is from the book of Daniel. Daniel's a book of it's considered a book of the prophets. It's got some prophecy section, but it's also got some pretty epic stories that you probably heard if you were in church when you were little, and some of you were, some of you weren't. But if you were, they were like Sunday school or kids' Bible stories because they're so crazy. And those are stories in Daniel, and then there's some prophecies in Daniel. Today, we're going to look at three big, fantastical stories in Daniel that are almost hard to believe. They're so crazy, two of them especially. We're going to look at three stories today because I'm trying to get this series done. And now, in times past, I would have done something like this in 3 weeks, one story for each week. I'm going to give you all three today. You know what that means? A, I'm going to talk fast, always. B, we're going to go a little over. Or C, both. Anyhow, but I'm going to do my best to give it all to you as fast as I can. So let's jump into the story of Daniel. And I hope that you'll get something out of today's material. Let's jump right in. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1 says, "During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem, and he besieged it." Now again, we saw that happen in three waves. It wasn't until the third and final wave when Jerusalem gets destroyed. But in these earlier iterations, these earlier sieges, he looted the city of Jerusalem, took the silver, the gold, the precious metals, and he also took a lot of the people, particularly the best and the brightest. In fact, Daniel tells us that he told his men during this conquest, in verse 4, he says, "Select only strong, healthy, good-looking young men." They would have chosen me had I been there. So, I'm hurt that you're laughing. I'm hurt, and I don't hurt easy. But anyhow, so it's only healthy, strong, and good-looking young men. And he said, "And make sure that they are well-versed in every branch of learning and are gifted with knowledge and good judgment and are suited to serve in the royal palace." What he's trying to do in Babylon, through all the nations they captured, including Jerusalem, is he's trying to bring in the best and the brightest, people who are sharp. So the good-looking people, the intelligent people, the people that help the aesthetics and the you know, politics and the invention side of things, just they want the place to be awesome. People come to the capital city, they are impressed with who they see, with what they see. And so he says, pick those kinds of people and bring them here. And then he says, train these young men in the language and the literature of Babylon. We're going to teach them to speak our language. They gave them Babylonian names. Most names people had were based upon their own belief systems. Usually they were tied to their faith in some ways. Happens today still to lots of people. And then others, you know, so Babylon gave them names that were associated with their Babylonian beliefs, their Babylonian gods. And they're going to teach them the language. They can speak the language. They can learn the literature. And they could ultimately serve in the royal service of the nation who's taken them into captivity. Are you with me? Then he says this, verse 5, "The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. That's a big deal, folks. This is back in the time, most of human history, up until recent modern times, people spend most of the days of their lives figuring out what they're going to eat today or tomorrow, and it's just like eke an existence out to get by. You know, give us this day our daily bread is a very serious prayer when you're just trying to figure out how to get by. You know, we live in a day of grocery stores and Instacart, you know, and it's just a different world. And so to be able to be in captivity, but be in a spot where you get access to the king's kitchen, and he's not going to run out of food, and you're going to get fed, and as you're being trained for 3 years, that's a 3-year security, and then put into the royal service. I'm not saying this is a good deal. I mean, they're in captivity, but let's be real. It could have been a whole lot worse. They could have been killed in the conquest. They could have been left behind in the rubble of the city that will eventually be destroyed. They could have been put into, trafficked into a worse form of slavery or something else. So as bad as it is, they are kind of in the best situation. They're going to be in the royal service. They're fed well. They're trained. They're going to be in a beautiful place. But they better keep up. Because Nebuchadnezzar's not messing around. You should know this. He is a conquistador. He is the man who has risen to power in Babylon, and he's knocking down the Assyrian Empire. He's pushing back the Egyptian kingdom. He has taken over Asia Minor with a force that is still understood in the history books today. He's a macro-minded driver. And he's not going to babysit these kids in training. He basically says, my decree is that you train these sharp people to serve in our kingdom. I got better things to do myself now. And so in the middle of all this, we find some people, including Daniel. Verse number 8 says this, but Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and the wine that was given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission to not eat these unacceptable foods. That's really interesting. He's determined not to eat this food. Now, why? Lots of people have speculated theologically through the centuries about why he wouldn't eat the food. Common answers include that if you happen to be a very devout Jewish young man, and not everyone was very devout to their religion like today, but if you were, there was dietary laws and restrictions of what you were allowed to eat, and this would be forbidden. Others would say it's because the food was offered to idols or to the Babylonian god Marduk and sacrifice. And there is a very large consensus that in a way, eating the food was an acknowledgement that Marduk is our provider and not God. And so whether it's the religious connotation of the food or whether it's the dietary laws of Jewish culture or whether Daniel was just a vegetarian, God rest his soul, if whatever it may have been, He determines, I'm not going to defile myself and eat this food. Now, here's the crazy part. Why? Why draw the line in the sand here? Can we be real? He's making a ton of other, quote-unquote, compromises, he's accepting other unideal circumstances, right? I mean, let's face it. They've changed his name to a Babylonian name. We don't really see his Babylonian name too often, just a couple times, because in this book it goes by Daniel. But he has three friends that join him in this determination. Their names are Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. And these three boys, their names are changed. And that could be a line in the sand. Or I'm not going to learn their literature. I'm not going to serve in your kingdom. Why does he draw the line on the food he's going to eat, of all things? And I think one possible answer to that question might be that Daniel couldn't control what people called him. He might say, this is my preferred name, but someone might not honor what he prefers to be called. And you can't control what people say to you or say about you or call you. So he's like, I can't control that, but I can control what I put in my body. I can control this vessel. And so that's where I'm going to firm up. I don't know. But for some reason, Daniel decides, I'm not going to eat these unacceptable foods. I'm going to live by my principles and my integrity, even though Nebuchadnezzar's not the guy you trifle with, and this could cost you dearly. You could, best case scenario, be tossed out of this opportunity and be a lowly, maybe slave somewhere else, or worst case scenario, death. But he decides that. Now, other Hebrew slaves here, other Hebrew boys who are brought into the service, they're like, shut up, Daniel. Look, when in Rome or when in Babylon, do as the Babylonians. You know, we're here. You got to do what you got to do. I mean, all those old laws were great, but we're not in Jerusalem anymore. That kind of went by the wayside. Just eat the good food, man. But Daniel and these three other friends join him in saying, yeah, we're with Daniel. We're not going to do it. Well, the problem is that the chief of staff, the man who is down the totem pole from Nebuchadnezzar a ways, whose job isn't to carry out his macro vision on the micro level of managing these kids. And by the way, they are kids. Daniel and these boys are teenagers. They're just, I mean, they're kids. They're teenagers. They're young. I know if you're a teenager, I'm not a kid. Us old people, you know. They're young. They're teens. They're brought away so they can be several years of education put in front of them so when they are young adults, they can serve in the system. They're not even there yet. So for Daniel to take a stand has got to be difficult at his age. It says in verse 9, now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. But he responded, I am afraid of my lord the king who has ordered you eat this food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I am afraid the king will have me beheaded. Like, it's not just your life in trouble, Daniel. If you do the wrong thing and he comes after you, he's also going to be like, why are these guys so sickly looking? Why aren't they looking like everybody else? They have a disease? No, they just wouldn't eat your food. Well, that's your job. I could lose my head. So it's not just your principles, it's my future. And Daniel understands. So Daniel says, listen, just give me and my friends a few days trial. Give us a little time, as much time as you'll give us, and see how it goes. If it doesn't work out that we're handling our alternative diet very well and we look poor, then we can reassess. You can either toss us to the curb or we'll reassess our beliefs because God doesn't seem to be helping us anyhow, or whatever. But give us a trial period. So the guy agrees to 10 days. 10 days of diet. Verse 15 says, at the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men who had been eating the food assigned by the king. I don't know how. Some people would say, well, I know how, because this kind of diet works best. Maybe. Maybe a supernatural intervention. I refuse to believe that not eating meat and eating only the vegetables is a better way. I refuse to accept that in my theology. But it says, so after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of the food and wine provided for the others. And then it says, God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. In other words, they stood out. They stood out as young youth in this kingdom that they're in captivity. They excelled in the system. And God even went a step further with Daniel specifically. He gave Daniel a special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. That's a prophetic ability that explains why Daniel is a book of the prophets. In fact, he's one of those spiritual clairvoyants that we talk about sometimes in his ability to understand these things. Now, it works out for them. But it doesn't always work out in life. We have some fantastical stories. That was story number one. Before I move on, I want to say a couple things about this one. There are times when people do the right thing and it costs them something. In the Bible, in history, this is one of those stories where Daniel did the right thing according to his principles and it worked out. But they didn't know it would. They didn't do it because they knew it would. They did it because they believed it was right to do whatever the consequences may be. When Daniel gets to the end of his life, as we're going to see in story 3, he is known as a man of integrity and impeccable character. And you look at that and say, I'd love to have my life story be that amazing. I'm known for being, but you know how you get there? You get there through a series of decisions. It's not just one day you say, I'll be awesome. It's a series of good decisions along the way. But can I say this to you as we get started? A lifetime of good decisions starts with one. It always starts with one. Now, I skipped a couple verses, but let me just tell you what they said. And I know, Caden, you didn't do anything wrong. It was me. But basically, without going back to them, the king basically, they have 3 years. They're brought in front of the king. The king checks out the young people who he's been training. These kids stand out amongst the others. And he gives them positions. Daniel goes one direction and is serving in the kingdom one way. The three other boys go a different direction. They're serving another way. And when it's all said and done, these four young men who took a stand on what they ate are not only serving in the royal service, but they end up in leadership roles in a land where they are captives. But a lifetime of good decisions starts with one. I want to say this to you. Because if you're a young person today like Daniel was, and you're like, I want to have my best life, start while you're young. Start before the stakes get higher. They might get higher someday, but you won't just suddenly do the hard thing later if you don't learn along the way to do the hard thing now. If the right thing is hard, do it because it's right. Daniel's whole story is one of integrity. Just to say, I want to be a person of integrity. And even if that means it costs me something or could, I'm going to do what's right. And you do that when you're young, make it a habit, and show yourself that God takes care of you when you do. And even if it doesn't turn out the way you want it to, it's still going to be okay in the end, and you're a better person for it. Start now. And maybe you're older. Maybe you're a little older, and you've not been making good decisions along the way. And you're like, well, I've not been doing that. No time like the present, right? Don't sit there and say, well, once I get through this one little part of my life where I'm unethical and I do some things that are wrong to get myself ahead in my business, but then after I get through this one thing, then I'll start making good, right decisions then. Don't. Just start now. A lifetime of good decisions starts with one. Well, this will lead to Daniel going one way, these three other Hebrew young men going the other way, and rising over the years in leadership. Well, one year brings us to story number two. Daniel chapter 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue that was 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Why would he make a big statue? I don't know, but can you imagine, like, construction, how it goes now? What are they building over there? It's going up, and it takes time, and it's like a statue, a giant statue. Why? Well, when he's done building it, he calls all the people of the provinces around them who were leaders, the mayors or the governors or whatever. He calls the leaders, all the important people, to a meeting at this giant statue. And in verse 4, it says, then a herald shouted out, people of all races and nations and language, listen to the king's command. When you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, harp, pipes, and other musical instruments, bow to the ground to worship King Nebuchadnezzar's gold statue. Now, this is interesting because now we know why the statue was built. Remember, and it says so in that previous verse, there are people from all nations that are gathered there. Captivity has brought people from other kingdoms to this location. They're all gathered around. And they're there to be because they can't go home. And so the king is like, King Nebuchadnezzar's a mover and shaker. He's a conquering maniac. And his macro picture is, look, I want the people who are here to see a statue that reminds them of who's their boss, who's the man, who's the king. And so I'm going to put the statue up, and the deal is whenever they hear the music shuffle, playlist shuffle, to bow down to the statue and to recognize my greatness and know their place in my kingdom, whether they were born here or they were brought here in captivity. This is his decree. But he's called the leaders because he wants the leaders to enforce it. And he says in verse 6, anyone who refuses to obey will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Now, we got to think about that for a moment, or we might overlook something. The furnace, the blazing furnace, is a form of capital punishment. Nations historically have always had forms of capital punishment, including our own. And sometimes even in our own nation's history, they've been pretty barbaric by today's, expectations, right? But in ancient times, they had capital punishment, sometimes cruel capital punishment. The kind of capital punishment that you use on people to make a point, to make an example of your enemy so they wouldn't mess with you again. For example, the Assyrian Empire, we saw them months ago, the Assyrian Empire would often impale people on a sharpened pole. Yikes. There's even a time up here they would skin people. That's another story. The Roman Empire to come in Jesus' day, we're not there yet, the Roman Empire would use what? Crucifixion, right. Crucifixion. And so now, Nebuchadnezzar's like, I have a fiery furnace. And it's got windows, it's got some kind of vantage point where he can see into it somehow, I don't know how. He can watch the people that he has tossed in there, he can watch them burn. Like, what a sick thing to do, right? But these are people you make an example out of. He's like, we're going to make the statue, you bow down to it, and if you don't, we'll make a spectacle out of you until everyone knows, don't mess with the king's bidding, remember who's the man. The problem is, in this group of leaders is those three Hebrew boys, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, whose names are changed to their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three are like, I ain't doing that. Because I won't even eat the king's meat earlier. I'm definitely not going to bow down to his golden image, you know? So but they can't slide under the radar. They're not some guys in the back alley somewhere. They are people of importance. And so people report back to people who report back to people who report back to the king. In verse 12, it says, but there are some Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you have put in charge of the province of Babylon. They pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods and do not worship the gold statue that you've set up. They are not complying, and they're in charge. They're like, they're going to undermine your authority. Well, that's not going to fly. And the king who's busy with this macro conquest doesn't want to slow down and deal with some stupid problem like this. This is an inconvenience to him, and he's mad. And so because of that, it says in verse 13 that Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage. And he ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. When they were brought in, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to worship, to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue that I have set up? Like, really? You're gonna be this way, and I've given you an opportunity to be of somebody in my kingdom, and you're gonna do this to me? He doesn't even wait for them to answer. I give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I've made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. Okay, so when the Spotify playlist starts back up, you do your thing, man. But if you refuse, he said, if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. I will make an example out of you, he says. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? Now, that may have been his big mistake. Because let's be honest, they could have easily died in that fire. I want to say this again and again. We read these stories and we're like, oh, 2,000 plus, 2,500 years later, oh, yeah, God rescues, popcorn time. They did not think there's a healthy way out of this predicament. And if you think that God always just bails people out of suffering for doing the right thing, read the Bible. John the Baptist gets beheaded in his prime. James the disciple gets killed for being a disciple, a follower of Jesus. I mean, Jesus is crucified at age 33. Let's go on and on and on, right? So there in history has taught us people are martyrs for their beliefs all the time. And so these guys could have been the next story of death for their beliefs. If there's a reason God intervened, it could be this one. The king's like, what God will be able to rescue from my power? It's almost like a dare, you know? Like, nobody, even God could not sink this ship, you know? It's like certain things, you just don't say those things out loud because you don't know what's going to happen. But that was their belief system. In ancient world back then, people believed in regional gods. Most people believed in regional gods. There was gods of this area, gods of that country, gods of that city. They believed in gods of different terrain, gods of the mountains, gods of the valleys. And in Babylon, they believed that Marduk was their deity. And if you were a conquering nation, that your god was more powerful than the other gods that you conquered, but you still respected them. Because you don't want to make them upset. You don't want to mess with your mojo on their turf. So you conquered them, but you usually, historically, respected the lands they were recognized in, even though yours was superior. So he's all about worshiping Marduk and himself. And he says, what god that didn't even save you from your city is going to stop you from me punishing you by death, by fire, if you don't do what I say? Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, they may have never seen him before in person. He's a big shot, but they're in front of him now. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. Don't miss that. He is able to save us. Then they said, this is a nuance here, he will rescue us from your power, your majesty. What they're saying is, he is able to literally save us from dying in the furnace. But either way, if he saves us from dying in the fiery furnace, then we're untouchable by you because you couldn't kill us. And if we die in the furnace, we're no longer touchable by you because we're gone. So either way, you have no power over us once this thing goes down. But God is able to save us. And then in the next verse, verse 18, he says this, even if he doesn't save us, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up. We want you to understand that God is able, but if he doesn't come through and we're prepared for that, it won't change what we're going to do. That's gutsy. That's faith. That's faith not just in God's ability, but faith in God's will, right? We teach that when we teach about prayer. When we say, learn to pray, what do we often say about prayer? Pray, God, I believe that you can do what I'm asking you to do. I believe you can. I'm asking that you will. That's faith in God's ability, but also faith in God's will and whatever he chooses to do. I believe you can. I'm asking that you will. Kind of what they're saying to Nebuchadnezzar. They're like, look, God can save us. He's able, but even if he doesn't, it won't change a thing. We're going to do the right thing and trust him. And can I just be impressed for a minute? You know what these guys just did? They decided that they would rather tell a good story than a long one. Right? Like they could have flown under the radar. They could have just said, okay, I'm sorry. Next time we're going to just do the bowing down thing. And then next time they would have bowed down. They said, Lord, we're doing this because we have to, but we don't mean it. God, know our hearts. You know, they could have excused it. They could have justified it. They could have just coasted under the radar, try to live a nice long life. But here's the thing. Even when you live a long life, you still die sometime. They'd still be 2,500 years gone. They decided, I'd rather tell a good story than a long one. I'd rather go down in a blaze of glory, no pun intended. I'd rather go down in a blaze, you didn't get that. No, I'd rather go down in a blaze of glory than to compromise my beliefs and my integrity so I can live a little longer and die later anyhow. That's gutsy, and that's impressive. Well, the king, for some reason, decides to have the furnace heated up. I don't know why you heat the furnace up. Like, was the fire not going to kill you at the last temperature? But whatever. He heats it up. He has them bound, and he has them thrown into the furnace. And it was so hot that the story tells us that the guys tossing them in were overcome by the furnace's temperatures, and they died. And Nebuchadnezzar assumes his perch to watch them roast. What a sick thing. Verse 24, but suddenly Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and exclaimed to his advisors, hey, didn't we tie 3 men up and throw them in the furnace? Yes, your majesty, we certainly did, they replied. Look, he shouted, I see 4 men unbound walking around in the fire unharmed. Like, first of all, we bound them. Did only the ropes burn up? They're walking around unharmed. They're roasting hot dogs. You know? And he says, and then there's a 4th man in there. We didn't put 4 men in there. And the 4th looks like a god. Wow. Remember, their worldview, there's gods everywhere, but ours is more powerful. We conquered him. But somehow this god is with these guys, and they're not dying in the fire, and he's walking around like somebody. This is a worldview shifter. Now, I know some of you may have an older translation of the Bible, and it might translate this phrase to say that one of them looks like the Son of God. And I just want to, if that's a thing you're reading in an older translation, and that is a hang-up for you, I just want to address that for a moment and take the time. That's not a translation from the Hebrew. Hebrew's hard to translate anyhow, but it doesn't do that. Somewhere an English translation decides, as a Christians, we're going to say, it was Jesus, and it may well have been, but that's not what it was saying here. Not even the Jewish people of the time looked at the promised Messiah as necessarily the term, oh, the Son of God, let alone the Babylonians. The word translates into, it looks like an angel of the gods, or maybe a son of the gods, or maybe a messenger of the gods, or like a god. It's hard to figure. But either way, Nebuchadnezzar in his own world says, what is this spiritual being, this angelic being in the fire with these guys all unharmed with ballpark franks? And he's shocked. Then Nebuchadnezzar came as close as he could to the door of the flaming furnace, and he shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. So I'm going to give him honor now. Whatever God you believe in, he's Most High. Come out. Come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stepped out of the fire. Then the high officers, the officials, governors, and advisors crowded around them and saw that the fire had not touched them. Not a hair on their heads was singed. Their clothing was not scorched. They didn't even smell like smoke. They're like, what? We were about to do s'mores, man. I mean, what do you want? They couldn't believe it. And so Nebuchadnezzar then said, praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel. Notice that's the phrase again. He doesn't know what this being was. He sent his angel, he says here. He sent his angel to rescue his servants who trusted in him. They defied the king's command and were willing to die rather than to serve or worship any god except their own God. They were willing to tell a good story instead of a long one. Then he said this, therefore I make this decree. If any people, whatever their race, nation, or language, speak a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they will be torn limb from limb and their houses will be turned into heaps of rubble. Yikes. There is no other God who can rescue like this. Now, don't misread this verse on the screen. This does not tell us that Nebuchadnezzar suddenly became a follower of Yahweh or some kind of Christian thing that wasn't around yet. That's not what's being said here. Nebuchadnezzar is going to continue worshiping Marduk, and the people worship a statue of himself, and everyone else is going to bow down to the gold statue. But he decides to make an exception for these guys. Like, these guys are untouchable. Like, no one's going to mess with them anymore because, wow. So they're given a free pass. He's acknowledging their God. He's not converting to their religion. And that's important to understand, and here's why that's important. It's important because, God is working in Nebuchadnezzar's heart. And he's not there yet, but if you read the history books and you read the stories that we've not gotten to yet, you'll see that God cared about old Nebuchadnezzar and was working on his heart. But he's not there yet. One more story. That's a lot today. I told you there's a lot today. One more story. It takes place many years later. Daniel is an old man. Those other three guys, they might be dead for all I know at this point. Again, who knows? Daniel's an old man. It's about 55 years after our first story when they were teenagers. So Daniel's probably around 70 years of age now. King Nebuchadnezzar's dead and gone because he was older. His descendant who took the throne is dead and gone because he didn't live long. And the Babylonian Empire has kind of crumbled and the Persian Empire is taking over and the king over the province of what was once Babylon is now a person whose name is Darius. Darius the Mede. Now, Darius is a title, just as you know this. Darius is like a title like the Pharaoh or the Herod. It's a common name for multiple leaders. Darius the Mede is the one ruling over this Medes and Persians, or this Persian Empire that's coming to power. And Daniel's like 70-ish right now. And he's still alive and he's still in government service. And that's where we pick up our last story today. It says that Darius the Mede, chapter 6, verse 1, by the way, Darius the Mede decided to divide the kingdom into 120 provinces. He appointed a high officer to rule over each of the provinces. The king also chose Daniel and two others as administrators to supervise the officers and protect the king's interest. What that's basically telling us is that as he subdivides the land into precincts with leaders, he has fewer leaders over those leaders and all the way up until the king. It's kind of a leadership structure he's building in the kingdom. And at the top of the leadership pyramid is Daniel and two other guys. And then it says in verse 3 that Daniel soon proved himself to be more capable than all the other administrators and the high officers. And because of Daniel's great ability, the king made plans to place him over the entire empire. In other words, Daniel would be his second in command, answering only to Darius. Now, can we just take a moment and be impressed? It's one thing when Daniel was a teenager to kind of stand out, and that's impressive enough. Like, if you're a teenager, that can resonate with you. Oh, wow, Daniel stood out. But now he's a 70-year-old man. He's not a spring chicken anymore. No offense to those of us who may be 70 or older. he's not a spring chicken anymore, right? But he still stands out. He is still running the kingdom. He's still like esteemed highly at this stage of his life. That's pretty impressive right there. Well, guess what's going to happen when you're trusted that high in government? There's a new government in town. Darius, the new governor, new leader. Guess what happens when you're in a position of leadership amongst your peers? People get what? Jealous. People get jealous. People want your spot. It happens in local politics. It happens in national politics. It happens in companies and jobs that someone gets jealous of your promotion or you get jealous of their promotion. They want to either knock them off and get rid of them out of jealousy or out of an attempt to take over their role. It's terrible, but it's what people, humans have done this for a long time. And Daniel's about to experience political and corporate sabotage. In verse 4, it says, the other administrators and high officers began searching for some fault in the way that Daniel was handling government affairs. Now, that should not be hard to do. He's a 70-year-old guy, folks. You know, there are entire firms today dedicated to digging up dirt on politicians so that you can either oust them or control them. Certainly, in 70 years of government work, Daniel's got some dirt. But it says, but they could not find anything to criticize or condemn. He was faithful, he was always responsible, and completely trustworthy. That's amazing. Wouldn't that be great if that was all of the leaders of our country today, everywhere in the world? He was always responsible, always trustworthy, always faithful. What in the world? And so they're sitting here saying, man, what do we do with this guy? Verse 5, they concluded, our only chance of finding grounds for accusing Daniel will be in connection with the rules of his religion. In other words, his religion being his faith. They call it his religion. If Daniel is so devout to his job as a good government worker to his authority, but also devout in his faith to his God, if we can get those two areas of his life to be at odds with each other, maybe we can find a fault with Daniel still. So, the administrators and the high officers went to the king, and they said, long live King Darius. They're going to butter him up. Always be careful when someone's buttering you up. Now, I'm not saying don't take a compliment. We should all learn to take compliments probably a little bit better. But especially when you're in a position of authority where you can affect someone's future or financial well-being or whatever, you can empower people. Be careful when people are complimenting you or criticizing you. You know, take both criticism and praise without going full extreme. It probably, there may be something behind it. They have an agenda. Long live King Darius, you are the best. We are all in agreement. We administrators, officials, officers, advisors, and governors, that the king should make a law that will be strictly enforced. Give orders that for the next 30 days, any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, except to you, your majesty, will be thrown into the den of lions. Now, notice the word the. They didn't say thrown into a den of lions. They said thrown into the den of lions, which means there was a specific den of lions, which means that this particular king, his preferred method of capital punishment to make an example out of his enemies that he wants to make an example out of, was not the Roman crucifixion or Nebuchadnezzar's fiery furnace or the Assyrians' impaling pole. He liked the den of lions, apparently. That's how we'll toss you in there. That's a terrible way to die, but you'll think twice before anyone else disobeys my commands, right? So they have a den of lions that are hungry enough to be executioners. And he says to the king, hey, make a law for 30 days. No one can pray to anyone but you. Why? Same reason Nebuchadnezzar made that statue earlier. You're the new guy. Everyone here from all these countries needs to know that you're the boss now. So 30 days is a reminder to everybody to give you their obeisance. It's just getting the country to fall in their place politically. And the king is like, oh, I see no problem with that. That's a great idea. Thanks for loving me so much. It's so nice to be popular, you know? So anyhow, in verse 8, they said, and now, your majesty, issue and sign this law so that it cannot be changed, an official law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be revoked. How many of you have heard of that before? The laws of the Medes and Persians that cannot be revoked. Is that familiar to you? Anybody? There is laws in the Persian kingdom that you could sign as an official, as a king or a ruler, that once you signed it, even you can't undo it. You have to put a certain signet on it. Why would someone pass the law? Like, why, you know, it's like, why do that? Why pass the law you can't undo? And there's a lot of reasons why. One I would like to offer is that maybe a king could pass a law and then get strong-armed or blackmailed or threatened with a family kidnapping or something that to undo this law for political reasons. But once this law is signed a certain way, it's untouchable, so just let it go. So they said, sign this law and seal it so you can't change your mind later. That was clever. So verse 9, King Darius signed the law, thinks they're trying to help his leadership. They love me. But what's Daniel going to do? What is Daniel, the man of faith at age 70, going to do in this situation? Verse 10, but when Daniel learned that the law had been signed, he went home and he knelt down as usual in his upstairs room. With his windows open toward Jerusalem, he prayed 3 times a day, just as he had always done, giving thanks to his God. I point that out to you because I know that when you read stories like this, there are some people who are just contrarians. We're like, yeah, Daniel's going to stick it to the man. They're going to say no to the king. That's not what's happening here. Daniel is not opposing the king out of some kind of, you know, draw me a line in the sand. Oh, yeah, well, then I'm going to step over just because. That's not what's happening here. Daniel didn't start praying all of a sudden to make a point that the king can't tell him what to do. He always obeyed the king. There was no fault to be found in him politically. They tried. I've known people religiously who don't really live out their faith in some practice until something in their evolved with their church or their movement tries to change something. Then all of a sudden they're like, wait, that's important to me. And they get all serious about it once again because they just want to make a point. That's not Daniel. Daniel always prayed. He goes home as usual. He goes to his room and opens the windows like he to pray towards the rubble of a city that used to be Jerusalem, as he had always done. Because he's not going to start doing it now to make a point, but he's not going to stop doing it now out of fear. And sure enough, it says, then the officials went together to Daniel's house, and they found him praying and asking for God's help. And so, of course, they told on him, hey, neener, neener, neener. Someone was breaking the law. Verse 14, hearing this, the king was deeply troubled, and he tried to think of a way to save Daniel. He spent the rest of the day looking for a way to get Daniel out of this predicament. In the evening, the men went together to the king, and they said, your majesty, you know that according to the law of Medes and Persians, no law of the king's signs can be changed. They're going to hold his feet. There's no more Mr. Nice Guy. No more, long live King Darius, rah, rah, rah. No, they're like, you signed the law. You got to kill him. The king at this point knows he was used. He should have listened to the flattery. He should have looked through the what were their intentions, but now he's stuck. And there's nothing he can do by law. And so, at the last, the king gave orders for Daniel to be arrested and thrown into the den of lions. The king said to him, notice this, the king doesn't just send his lackeys to do the dirty work. He goes and faces Daniel face to face like a, that's hard to do. He goes to see Daniel and it says to him, may your God whom you serve so faithfully rescue you. Can I be transparent? I don't think the king believed God was going to rescue him. I don't think that's what he's saying. Because you're not going to survive a den of lions. I think what the king is saying is, I hope you somehow survive. Because I don't want this. This was not my intention. I am bound by law because I got tricked into this whole thing. I have no choice to throw you in, but I don't want you to die. So I hope that somehow, against all odds, you survive. And then the king returned to his palace, and he spent the night fasting. He didn't. Here's your food, king. Nope, not eating tonight. He refused his usual entertainment. Hey, it's a Netflix show. Nope, nothing tonight. The football game. Nope, not watching it. He couldn't sleep at all that night. Very early the next morning, tired, of course, the king got up and hurried out to the lion's den. When he got there, he called out in anguish, Daniel, servant of the living God, was your God whom you serve so faithfully able to rescue you from the lions? Again, maybe he believed it was likely, but this is not, I know we like to Christianize this. He wasn't a man of some weird faith. He was just a conquering just a worldly king who just barely knew Daniel for very long, just liked him. I don't think he's believing Daniel's alive. I think he's rushing. Look at the word anguish there. I think he's rushing to the scene of the crime to lament the tragedy before the coroner gets there and hauls the body away. There's no body to be hauled away, by the way. He's like, oh, damn. You know, he's just torn. Is there a chance you're alive? Is there a chance that you're alive? In verse 21, Daniel answered, long live the king! And the king is shocked and has a heart attack and dies. Oh. Long live the king. My God sent his angel to shut the lion's mouth so that they would not hurt me, for I have been found innocent in his sight, and I have not wronged you, your majesty. Interesting. So Daniel said, I could have died. I didn't know that it was going to turn out. But God seemed fit to spare me, and I don't know why, but here's a speculative reason. Maybe it's because I was innocent in his sight and I've not wronged you. I wasn't some kind of contrarian saying, oh yeah, make a law. I ain't gonna break your, I'm gonna keep your stupid laws. He was saying, I always did what was right in my government job. I was always right in my role, in my job, towards my authority, and I was always right in my faith. And when there was a clash, I just tried to stay true to God, but I never tried to harm you. And God chose to spare me. Interesting. Then the king was overjoyed, and he ordered that Daniel be lifted from the den. Not a scratch was found on him, for he had trusted in his God. Whew. Cool story. In fact, we won't read the rest of the story, but he basically decides to dispatch himself of the guys who tried to get Daniel killed. And it didn't turn out well for them in the end. Here's the bottom line. These are crazy stories. These are the stories that you hear. They're like, really? Is that possible? I get it. You know, Daniel, the lion's den, the fiery furnace, Jonah and the whale. I know, they're big stories. But what are they teaching us? What is the story? And Daniel's a famous prophet in Israel. His story is epic. His prophecies are enduring. They're very accurate. He makes some very accurate predictions that happen in the future. He's a pretty epic person in the books of the history of Israel. And what do you do with these stories? Well, we're going to finish today. We have 6 more messages to go before we're done with the Old Testament. But as we wrap up today, and I need to wrap up because it's late. We got to sing a song, a couple songs. But before I do, I want to just say a couple things. How do you get to Daniel's spot in life where he was known to be such an amazing, forget the lion's den. He was known to be so epic. How do you get there? A lifetime of good decisions always begins with what? 1. Teenagers, young people, you call it youth, you youths today, you youths, while you're young, decide today that I'm going to start making decisions that I can live with. I can look myself in the mirror and say I did the right thing regardless of the outcome. Because life will make it more complicated. The stakes will get higher like they did for these guys down the road. And you can teach yourself at a young age to do the right thing. And if you're an older person and you've not been doing the right thing, don't wait till you get out of this business deal and just a little more crooked behavior and then I'll start doing the right thing someday. Start now. Start now. Do what's right and trust it will work out. And if it doesn't work out the way you want it to, it's still better off. In fact, that's the big point of the story. In fact, if I want to close by saying that to you, would some of you consider joining me in saying, like the Hebrew young men, that I would rather tell a good story than a long one? Don't take me wrong. I would like to tell a good, long story. That's my vote. I want to be the Lord of the Rings of the stories, you know. Good, long story. That's what I'm going for. Okay? But if life happens to where, you know, and it probably won't. We live in a charmed modern day of peace. But if something happens in life where there's a fork in the road, you could either have a long story or a good one. Choose a good one. Now, some of you are like, that's crazy. I'm choosing a long one. I'm just going to skate under the radar, do what I got to do, survival of the fittest. I understand, and I don't blame you for feeling that way. But can I just offer you a counter thought? You're going to die anyway. And you know what happens when you get old? Quote-unquote long life is not that long. And the older we get, the more we realize how fast life goes, right? It seems like it goes faster all the time. So I get to the end, and I say I did what I had to do for me, no matter what was wrong in the journey, and I got to live a little longer, and it still went by too fast, and I'm still going to die. And we're all going to go in the end some way. And it's going to be something. It could be an accident, which might be uncomfortable. It might be a disease, which is uncomfortable. I'm not saying it's a fiery furnace, but death is usually not a hurrah. And at some point, we're going to go anyhow. So why live for a slightly longer one at the expense of doing what's right? Tell a good story. And maybe it's not for us in a modern day. It's not life and death. Maybe it's career. You can have a long story to tell at that company, or you can do the right thing and have a short story at that company, but do the right thing, right? You can do the right thing in this relationship or have a long one. I'd rather tell a good story than a long one any day of the week. Because here's the thing. A good story is a legacy. A good story helps somebody, whether it's people 2,500 years later like us, or whether it's people in your family or your descendants or people around you who say, wow, I admire that. That inspires me to be my best self. Choose a good story over a long one if it comes down to it. And hopefully it doesn't. Hopefully we get both. But if we don't, good trumps long every day of the week.